From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson. Glad to have you with us today. We've got a few of our favorite podcasts to play for you and share along the way, like this one with Taiwan, usually very wet and rainy this time of year. We examine the dry truth of the drought there, though, on Daybreak Asia. The United States is the destination of choice for higher learning. However, a new superpower in education may be emerging. That's on our weekly education report. The question of the economy remains for China. Sarah Williams answers with analysis on China Focus. Washington is currently awash in pink and white flowering trees. Ira Melman cherry picks one of our favorite annual stories on the American Cafe. David Berg gets touchy with technology on today's edition of Now. We'll also have music, business, and sports. It's all coming your way today on VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia. Welcome to our summary of Asian news and events for Monday, April 15th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, normally rainy Taiwan is rationing water to ease its worst drought in a decade. The Western Pacific island that averages annual rainfall of 2,500 millimeters has seen the lowest levels in 67 years since October, depleting reservoirs that serve the most populated cities and counties. The government has cut household and industrial use until rainfall returns to normal. Fortunately, Ralph Jennings doesn't have to ration his words, as he joins us now from Taipei.
Low rainfall over the past year has led Taiwan's central government to ration water, saving about 500,000 tons so far. In parts of northern Taiwan, households are now able to receive tap water just 5 days a week, prompting some to store up in advance. About 800,000 households had been affected as of March. In industrial regions, factories are recycling water and cutting back on air conditioning. Water Resources Agency spokesman Lai Jianxin blames a shift in ocean temperatures for rainfall of just 1,643 millimeters last year. He says that, of course, part of the reason is related to temperatures of the Pacific Ocean, and that a cold, dry band of air has been aimed at Taiwan, resulting in a trend of low rainfall all of last year. Officials decided in November, after monitoring water levels for 2 months, to begin rationing supplies. Rationing affects all or part of 9 cities and counties along Taiwan's densely populated west coast. The drought has unleashed criticism over suspected leaky pipes and reservoirs that are too old or too clogged with silt to hold whatever rain falls. Sherman Reservoir, which serves much of northern Taiwan, was at about a quarter of capacity as of April 8. Low-flush, low-flow bathroom equipment is also rare on the island of 23 million people. Lai with the Taiwan Water Resources Agency says the government wants to double the amount of dredging now so reservoirs can hold more water. He says the agency is always continuing to carry out this kind of work. But due to the drought situation, Lai says, authorities are moving toward the biggest reservoir dredging measures ever with a goal of at least doubling the average level they have normally dredged in the past. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou said last month that by May he would try and head off a water shortage that would more seriously affect common households. He also called for better management of Taiwan's water. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
This week, South Korea marks the one-year anniversary of one of the country's deadliest maritime accidents. Hundreds of passengers on board the Sewol ferry died last year after the ship capsized in waters off of the peninsula's south coast. An investigation found the boat was overloaded and had undergone modifications that made it unstable. The ferry still rests on the ocean's floor, but the relatives of those still missing now want it raised. Jason Strother has more from the island of Jindo near the location where the ship went down.
The concrete pier at Pangmok Port extends a few hundred meters into the sea. It's now covered with painted tiles, banners, and yellow ribbons, a tribute to the victims of the Sewol ferry disaster. It was here a year ago on April 16th that rescuers brought back to land the 172 survivors of the accident, and over the following months, the nearly 300 bodies of those who drowned when the ship capsized and sank. In November, the recovery effort was called off, even though 9 bodies remain missing. Some of the victims' families believe their bodies are still trapped inside the wreck. And some of those relatives now stay in small cabins adjacent to the port. One of them is 60-year-old Kwan O Bok, whose brother and nephew have not been found. He says he feels frustrated. The government is playing a game with us, he says. Last year they said they would lift the ship. Now they say they need to review the plan. He says this ordeal keeps dragging on. Raising the ferry and recovering those missing will help bring closure to the families, says 46-year-old Lee Gum-hee. Her teenage daughter was one of the many high school students on board the Sewol that day and has still not been found. We watched our children die live on TV and here at the port, she says. She adds there are still many questions left unanswered. And now many of the Sewol families and their supporters are again calling on the South Korean government to provide answers about the accident. Back in his cabin at the Jindo port, Kwan O Bok says he is not going anywhere for now. He says he will not leave until there is a solid plan to recover the missing bodies. Jason Strother for VOA News, Jindo, South Korea.
Today is the 103rd birthday of North Korea's founding leader, Kim Il-sung. The day is observed as a national holiday. Human Rights Watch says his 46 years as leader of the reclusive communist country created a state characterized by rights violations and crimes against humanity. Pyongyang typically observes what they call the Day of the Sun with sporting events and festivals. Mr. Kim died in 1994. This year's observance comes as the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights sets up a field office in Seoul to monitor and study the North Korean rights situation. Human Rights Watch Deputy Asia Director Phil Robertson told VOA's Victor Beatty this is no time for celebration of a man who established an authoritarian government that annihilated civil and political rights, purged and persecuted dissidents, and created a personality cult that compelled absolute obedience.
Most of the UN Security Council members in late December voted in support of putting the North Korean human rights record on its agenda. What has happened since then? Here it is, the middle of April.
Well, we're expecting that the UN Security Council will continue to receive regular briefings and updates from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, specifically the High Commissioner himself, about the situation in North Korea. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is in the process of setting up an office that will be based in Seoul that will then carry on the research mission looking into these abuses. The office, which we expect to be operational sometime next month, will become a new focus point for research detailing the abuses in, for instance, forced labor camps or political prison camps, the executions that are carried out by the government to intimidate people, the efforts to prevent people from fleeing the country or even moving within provinces. All the sorts of abuses that we have come to find have been committed by the North Korean government over the years and now have become public information and knowledge.
Robertson says while he expects China to block any effort in the UN Security Council to refer the North's rights record to the International Criminal Court, tensions between Beijing and Pyongyang have been rising. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. At voanews.com, we have these and many more stories from the region. Stop by and take a look. And while you're there, stop by and subscribe to our free Daybreak Asia podcast. We always love to hear from you and your comments on many of the stories that we put out on our website, which is voanews.com. One of our recent stories posted, Pakistan's prime minister sought to reassure Saudi Arabia and its Arab coalition in Yemen that his country does not abandon friends and strategic partners, especially at a time when their security is under threat. Nawaz Sharif's assurance came after a flurry of statements from officials in Arab countries expressing their disappointment at Pakistan for refusing to join their coalition. Saudi Arabia had requested Pakistan for ground troops along with naval vessels and aircraft. John replied to our story. He said, I must admit, I sympathize with Pakistan. to involve itself in a war in Yemen would simply be foolish. I'd naturally like to see the whole mess smoothed over and some sort of ramshackle compromise worked out that will stop the fighting. Still, the Saudis feel threatened by a Shiite Yemen, so no doubt the war will go on. Certainly, the Saudis are at present using insufficient force to gain a victory. Alam from Saudi Arabia wrote, "In my opinion, Pakistan is Sunni-majority Muslim country and Saudi also. And while Iran is killing Sunni at Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Libya, also now started at Yemen, why Pakistan is not understanding these issues and not helping Saudi Arabia? Nawaz Sharif is not helping the Sunni," he writes. President Barack Obama discussed the threat of foreign fighters in Iraq and U.S. aid to Baghdad during a visit to the White House by the country's prime minister, Hadir Abdi. And Genesis writes, "These evil Islamic militants are winning because your bombs are missing the targets for some reason." Well, we'd love to read your comments on these and other stories. They're all on our website at voanews.com. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America, and we'd also like to pass along our email address, voaasia@voanews.com. You can write to us just about anything you like. Send us an email. We'd love to hear from you, voaasia@voanews.com. You know, many programs I've mentioned, we've been coming out of Studio 23. We actually moved next door to Studio 22 because they were doing some rewiring and renovation, but a nice studio nonetheless, Studio 22.
I'm Ira Melman with a report on education. As more and more students come from Asia to the United States and other Western nations for their higher education, a new publication says a shift is taking place, making Asia the next educational superpower. I spoke with the book's editor, Rajika Bandari, is the director of the Center for Academic Mobility for the publisher, the Institute for International Education.
The shift is indeed underway, but what we do see is that there are some countries who are certainly ahead of the game, countries that for many years now have had a strong higher education sector. So these would include, for example, China and Japan and India. So certainly the shifts there are underway and have been for a while. But there are, what we're also seeing is the rise of other rapidly emerging economies that are making significant investments in their higher education sectors and are thus really expanding the role that higher education plays in their countries and also helps them engage internationally. So what we've tried to do is focus not just on the big players, but also really look at what's happening in some of these other emerging economies, such as Vietnam and Malaysia.
What are the driving factors behind the shift? What is needed? What is being done?
I think two of the driving factors are the rise of knowledge economies, or with countries in Asia now really transitioning into being knowledge economies, and the realization that there need to be investments in higher education to really build the knowledge economy. So I think that is one factor. The other driving force, I think, in some countries is to really position some of their universities and colleges on the world stage as key players and as being globally competitive. So that would be more in response to almost the external forces of global rankings and wanting to demonstrate that their countries too have some of the top institutions in the world. But I think there are, in response to your question of what still needs to be done, I think one of the key issues that continues to be a concern for some Asian countries is infrastructure issues, that countries can have high ambitions and aspirations, but how do they really match their investments in infrastructure to those aspirations to see the sort of higher education growth that they're aspiring to? I think quality assurance is another area that continues to be an issue, especially in countries where there's a history of academic corruption and weak education quality. So as these countries move forward with expansion and with growth, there will be a real need to assure the quality of higher education.
Are Asian universities having to play on a Western scale, or are they able to incorporate some of their Eastern traditions?
I think what's happening with many Asian countries right now is this struggle to reconcile, if you will, their domestic systems and their educational histories with outside of global forces such as rankings, which may constitute a pressure to be globally competitive or conform to a global notion of excellence. But that, in fact, for many Asian countries, especially the ones that are developing, a key concern will be that how do they also focus inward and focus on their domestic populations and really build their domestic higher education capacities.
Rajika Bhandari, the director of the Center for Academic Mobility at the Institute for International Education. I'm Ira Melman with Report on Education, online at voanews.com.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Just days before it releases its first quarter economic growth number, China said export growth contracted 15% in March, a surprise to some analysts who had predicted an expansion. China's trade imbalance last month fell sharply to under $3.1 billion. Imports also fell in March, the latest sign of weakness in the world's second largest economy, raising the specter of politically sensitive job losses. China's central bank has cut a key interest rate twice since November. The conference board's chief Beijing economist, Andrew Polk, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the downward trend in Chinese exports has more to do with international weakness, not necessarily weak domestic demand in China.
Movement around the Chinese New Year, we had unusually high year-over-year growth in January and February, so there may have been just some give back in March. There was clearly some downward pressure on the renminbi the central bank was pushing against, so it had been appreciating the currency when the currency wanted to depreciate, and so that obviously makes Chinese exports more expensive, so that may have hit some of the growth as well. Overall, it doesn't necessarily signal more weakness in China. It has more of a signal for weakness abroad, weakness in the global economy. Of course, that will end up showing in a slower Chinese growth rate, but you know, it doesn't really reflect weak domestic demand for China.
The French press agency has a survey that it says the gross domestic product in China weakened to a new post-financial crisis low in the first quarter at 6.9%. Is that a surprising figure, or is that something that you expect to be announced this week?
We're in line with that expectation. Our expectation is slightly lower, 6.8, but of course, you know, that's basically the same print there. We do expect sub 7. We kind of expected the deceleration in Chinese growth that's happened over the past 2 or 3 years. We expect it to continue for several years hence. So it's not surprising to us that we're starting off on a weak foot in 2015. Q1 tends to be cyclically weak, and then you add the structural kind of downward pressure on China's economy, and it's not surprising that we are likely going to fall below 7%.
China is expected to announce its first quarter growth figure on Wednesday. Meanwhile, on Monday, the World Bank revised downward its forecast growth for China and the developing East Asia region to 6.7%, for both this year and next, compared with the 6.9% in 2014. Sudhir Shetty, the bank's chief economist for the East Asia-Pacific region, says while the bank sees continued robust growth, there are three main challenges from the global economy.
One is around growth in the advanced economies in the U.S., Japan, and the euro area, whether that growth will be as robust as we project. And by robust, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but at least that it will be of the order of 2%. So one risk is around the slowing of that growth. The second is around what in the report we call the divergent monetary policies in the advanced economies, the fact that U.S. interest rates will most likely rise towards the latter part of this year, whereas in the euro area and Japan, they will continue to ease monetary policy. And what that means is you will have volatility in the currency markets, and which could then spill over into volatility in capital flows and higher borrowing costs for borrowers in East Asia Pacific who borrowed in dollars. And the third risk is around China's growth. Now, here we anticipate that China will slow gradually to about 7% over the next 2 or 3 years. But having said that, it is possible that China's growth could slow more drastically than that, and that would have impacts on the region. It's not something we assign a high probability to, but it's something that is certainly worth keeping on the radar screens for policymakers in this area.
Are you advocating stimulus measures?
Not at present, no. Because, you know, for most of developing East Asia Pacific, the oil price decrease has in effect been a stimulus.
Shetty says the bank expects the economies of developing Asian countries such as Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines to expand faster than they did in 2014. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Japan's Nikkei share average was flat Tuesday as investors preferred to pull back a little after the recent rally as they prepared for the looming earnings season. The Nikkei closed at 19,908, just off of a 15-year intraday high of 20,006, which they touched on Friday. Hong Kong stocks retreated, breaking an 8-day winning streak as Tencent Holdings Limited slumped after its chief executive reduced his holdings in China's biggest social networking and online entertainment firm. Tencent's market capitalization topped $200 billion for the first time Monday on the back of Hong Kong's recent bull run. But it tumbled 5.5% Tuesday on its biggest single-day drop in nearly a year. The Hang Seng Index fell 1.6%. It now sits at 27,561, the China Enterprises Index losing more than 2% to close at 14,264. The yen is fairly valued around current levels, that according to a key economic advisor to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, a day after comments were made and taken to mean that the yen was too weak. Koichi Hamada, an emeritus professor of economics at Yale University, also told the Reuters news agency he was not suggesting the Bank of Japan ease policy at its next meeting this month, in contrast to the recent views of another Abe advisor. He was quoted Monday as saying a 105 yen rate was acceptable, but sought on Tuesday to clarify that he had been referring to the purchasing power parity implied rate, which that's about 101 yen, not the spot market rate. That's a look at Asia Business News from the Voice of America, heard daily on VOA Global from VOA.
This is Today in History. On April 15th, 1452, artist, architect, and scientist Leonardo da Vinci was born in the Florentine city of Vinci. Best known for his paintings of the Last Supper and the Mona Lisa, da Vinci's thirst for knowledge also resulted in a vast array of innovative designs and inventions. On this day in 1755, the comprehensive A Dictionary of the English Language was published. Contracted to write a dictionary by a group of London booksellers, Samuel Johnson took 9 years to complete the task. The scope and structure became a template for dictionaries that followed. In 1865, Abraham Lincoln died after being shot the previous evening by John Wilkes Booth. In 1892, the General Electric Company was formed. GE became one of the world's largest corporations. In 1912, the RMS cruise liner Titanic sank in the North Atlantic on its maiden voyage from England to New York. More than 1,500 passengers and crew died in one of history's most notorious maritime disasters. In 1955, entrepreneur Ray Kroc opened his first McDonald's restaurant in DePlain, Illinois. Originally a business started by California brothers Dick and Mac McDonald, Kroc bought all the rights and expanded the McDonald's concept to become one of the world's leading fast food restaurants. In 1986, President Ronald Reagan ordered U.S. warplanes to attack targets in Libya. The attack was in retaliation for the bombing of a West Berlin discotheque
blamed on Libyan-backed terrorists. In 2013, two bombs exploded near the finish line at the Boston Marathon in Boston, Massachusetts, killing three people and wounding 264. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, the U.S. Congress takes a major step toward giving itself a say in any nuclear deal between Iran and world powers. President Obama offers Iraq's visiting leader humanitarian rather than military aid. And Nigeria marks 1 year since the kidnapping of more than 200 schoolgirls by Boko Haram. I'm Michael Lippin. A U.S. Senate panel has unanimously approved bipartisan legislation that would give Congress the right to review any final nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, including the United States. The measure approved on Tuesday would give U.S. lawmakers 30 days to review and vote on any nuclear deal that the Obama administration might sign with Iran and the other powers. No U.S. congressional sanctions on Iran could be removed during that 30-day period. VOA's Michael Bowman has more from Capitol Hill.
In a concession to some wavering Democratic lawmakers, the bill omits specific stipulations on side issues such as Iran's support for terrorist groups and Israel's right to exist. It does, however, mandate frequent consultations between the administration and lawmakers on Iran's compliance with any deal and allow sanctions to be swiftly reimposed if violations are detected. Republican Senator Bob Corker is the committee's chairman.
The sanctions that have been put in place by this body, by the Senate and by the House, cannot be lifted without the administration bringing to us every detail of the deal. Then the clock will start. Congress stays involved, and every 90 days, the administration has to certify that in every way, Iran is in compliance.
Even some Democrats most loyal to the White House, like Senator Debbie Stabenow, said Congress cannot be silent on an Iran nuclear deal.
I think that we should have a say in some way.
At a briefing, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said President Obama will reserve final judgment until a bill is passed, but added the following.
The president would be willing to sign the proposed compromise that's working its way through the committee today.
Now the bill goes before the full Senate. Passage is all but assured in the Senate and the House. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Israel's prime minister has expressed grave concern to Russia about its decision to sell sophisticated air defense systems to Iran. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says that is what he told Russian President Vladimir Putin in a Tuesday phone call. It says Mr. Netanyahu warned that a Russian transfer of the S-300 air defense system to Iran would only encourage what he called Iranian aggression in the region. The Kremlin says Mr. Putin responded to Mr. Netanyahu's concerns by saying the missile defense system will not threaten the security of Israel or other Middle Eastern countries. U.S. President Barack Obama has offered to provide Iraq with new humanitarian aid worth $205 million. Mr. Obama made the pledge to Iraq's visiting Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi in the White House meeting on Tuesday. But Mr. Obama made no public commitment to provide the additional military support that Mr. Abadi has been seeking to help the Iraqi government to fight off an insurgency by the Islamic State group. Two leaders met, Mr. Obama gave this assessment of U.S. cooperation with Iraq since Mr. Abadi took office 7 months ago.
So our coordination, I think, has consistently improved over time as Prime Minister Abadi has gained greater control over Iraqi security forces.
The United States says U.S.-led airstrikes against the Islamic State have helped Mr. Abadi's government to retake about a quarter of the Iraqi territory seized by the militants over the past year. The United Nations Security Council has approved a resolution imposing an arms embargo on the leaders of Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels. The council voted 14-0 in favor of the resolution on Tuesday, with Russia abstaining. The measure also demanded that Houthi rebels withdraw from the Yemeni capital Sana'a and all other territory they have captured. Russia's UN ambassador Vitaly Churkin said Moscow abstained because the resolution does not call for an end to Saudi-led airstrikes on the rebels. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a deadly assault on a Somali government complex in the capital Mogadishu. A Somali security ministry spokesman told VOA that the attack on the country's higher education ministry killed 18 people and wounded at least 15 others. A witness said the militants set off a car bomb outside the ministry walls, allowing the attackers to storm the building and then open fire. A children's aid group says about 400 migrants have died in a shipwreck while trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. The Italian office of Save the Children reported the disaster on Tuesday, citing survivors from another migrant boat who were rescued and taken to southern Italy. Save the Children said the latest shipwreck happened about 24 hours after the boat left the coast of Libya without providing further details. It said that among the victims were many young boys. There's been no comment from the Italian Coast Guard, which watches the Mediterranean for struggling migrant boats. Nigeria's president-elect Muhammadu Buhari says he cannot promise that authorities will find the 219 schoolgirls kidnapped 1 year ago by Boko Haram militants in the northeastern village of Chibok. He made the comment in a statement on Tuesday as the country was marking the one-year anniversary of that mass abduction. Well, rights group Amnesty International said the militants have abducted at least 2,000 women in Nigeria since the start of 2014 and forced many of them into sexual slavery and armed combat. Well, it has been 1 year since Boko Haram kidnapped those schoolgirls from Chibok. VOA's Chris Stein reports that that marchers took to the streets of the Nigerian capital Abuja to mark the anniversary.
Bring Back Our Girls protest group has been rallying every day since the kidnapping at the Unity Fountain in Abuja. On the one-year anniversary, they staged a march from the fountain to the Ministry of Education to air their grievances about why the girls have not been rescued. Those in the march were schoolgirls themselves, meant to represent the kidnapped girls. Miriam Yakubu Akunye helped organize the rally. Her 8-year-old niece is also one of the marchers.
It is very sad. Sometimes when you think about this, it's like you have an out-of-body experience. Children are alive, went to school, and this happened to them. They disappeared, and now it's 360 days.
There was no such public memorial in the town of Chibok, says Ayuba Alamson, an elder in the town. Many people preferred to stay inside, deterred by the larger military presence in Chibok, which was captured briefly by Boko Haram last November. Many families still hold out hope of seeing their daughters again, he says. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
And just before we go, U.S. President Obama says he intends to take communist nation Cuba off of the United States list of state sponsors of terrorism as part of his efforts to normalize relations with Cuba after 5 decades of hostilities. I'm Michael Lippin. You're listening to VOA News.
I'm Jim Stevenson with business news from the Voice of America. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 ended higher Tuesday, helped by energy stocks and March quarter earnings reports that top modest expectations following worries about a strong dollar. Shares of ExxonMobil, Chevron, and other energy companies followed crude oil higher after a forecast that the U.S. shale oil output in May would record its first monthly decline in more than 4 years. A strong dollar, cheap oil, and poor weather in the eastern United States in recent months have investors bracing for a difficult March quarter earnings season. Those lowered expectations, though, also mean that companies can now more easily impress investors. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 60 points to close at 18,036, the S&P 500 gaining more than 3 points. It sits at 2095, and the NASDAQ composite dropping more than 10 points to close at 4977. The race for renewable energy has passed a turning point. The world is now adding more capacity for renewable power each year than coal, natural gas, and oil combined. and appears to be no going back. The shift occurred in 2013 when the world added 143 gigawatts of renewable electricity capacity, compared with 141 gigawatts in new plants that burn fossil fuels, according to an analysis that was presented Tuesday at the Bloomberg New Energy Finance Annual Summit, which was held in New York. The shift will continue to accelerate, and by 2030, more than four times as much renewable capacity will be added, according to that summit. That's a look at business news from the Voice of America. So-called virtual reality in computer video games or other applications has created many spectacular experiences for people using them. And until now, virtual reality has not included one very important element to our senses. That's touch. David Byrd touches on this new technological development on today's edition of Now. But first, some famous trees planted more than a century ago still draw tens of thousands of people to see them. That's on the American Cafe.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. The Washington National Cherry Blossom Festival draws more than a million visitors to the D.C. area every year. The famous trees, gifts from Japan more than a century ago, continue to announce the arrival of spring with vibrant colors. VOA's Yang Chen went to check out this year's eruption of pink and white flowers. It's narrated by Lin Yang.
Anne McLellan, author of Cherry Blossoms, the official book of the National Cherry Blossom Festival, says the blossoms are an inspiration.
Everyone from anywhere can experience how beautiful they are and know that hope that comes with them, that no matter how bad the winter is, spring comes when the trees bloom. And not only that, how short each life is.
The cherry blossoms also symbolize the friendship between the U.S. and Japan. In 1912, Tokyo donated 3,000 cherry trees to Washington, which planted them around the Taito Basin.
They were given with the intent of thanking the United States for its role in brokering the peace treaty of Portsmouth, which ended the Russo-Japanese War.
But during World War II, after Japan attacked the U.S. naval base in Pearl Harbor, some of the cherry trees were cut down. Anne McLellan said local people formed groups to protect the trees.
They patrolled the tidal basin area at night to make sure that no other trees were cut down. They did call the trees the Oriental cherry trees for the remainder of the war.
The tradition of the Cherry Blossom Festival started in 1935. Bob Vogel, National Capital Regional Director for the National Park Service, said over the years it has evolved into a festival of the culture, art, music, and a celebration of friendship between the two people.
It's a wonderful bonding experience between our two countries, and of course that was the original idea, and I think it's really fostered and grown.
Lin Yang for Yang Chen, VOA News, Washington.
On April 14, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. VOA's Julie Tabo takes a look at Lincoln's key achievements and how an iconic theater in Washington is commemorating the historic anniversary.
President Abraham Lincoln was shot as he and his wife Mary watched a play at Ford's Theater in Washington. As his assassin John Wilkes Booth fled, Mr. Lincoln was carried to a house across the street from the theater, where he died the following morning. His death came just as he was leading the nation out of a long and bloody civil war that had led to the deaths of more than 620,000 soldiers. Saving the Union was one of the most remarkable achievements of his presidency, says Michelle Crowell, a historian at the Library of Congress.
In the hands of a lesser man, hands of a less resolute person, one who was less politically astute, it could have easily gone the other way. But he saw the United States as an experiment in democracy, that he was upholding what the founding fathers had started, and he didn't want that experiment in democracy to fail.
Museums and historic institutions all across the country are featuring special exhibits and performances. One of the most significant is at Ford's Theater Compound. Here, objects are being presented together for the first time since that tragic evening. They include the small, single-shot pistol that John Wilkes Booth used to shoot the president. Tracy Avant, curator of exhibitions, says many of Mr. Lincoln's personal possessions are also on display, including his signature top hat.
Well, it's a beautiful, iconic piece. Everyone thinks of Abraham Lincoln with a top hat. But what I love about it is it's got this beautiful band that he put on it to remember his son, Willie, who had died in 1862 of typhoid fever. It speaks to how deeply he felt that loss.
While his life was cut short, Mr. Lincoln's legacy lives on as one of the greatest presidents in U.S. history. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe, where you have a standing reservation at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. You might be familiar with virtual reality through things like Facebook's Oculus Rift, a video game on your smartphone, or other applications. But until now, they have offered sight and sound, but touch, actually feeling what you're seeing, that's been pretty much absent. But a British company is aiming to change that. Ultra Haptics in Bristol, England, has developed a technology that uses sound waves to give you the feeling of what you're seeing. Professor Sriram Subramanian co-developed the technology at the University of Bristol's Computer Science Department.
If you go to a nightclub or to a rock concert, you feel the music in your chest, it's the same principle, right? So you feel the sound vibrating your chest and you feel it. And instead of using the bass sounds, what we use is low-frequency ultrasound, about 40 kilohertz. And that way we can target it as a precise point on your fingertip or on your palm, and then you feel the palm vibrate, and it feels precise as well.
The way this technology works, the sound waves create complex patterns of air disturbances. Those disturbances can be controlled and then manipulated into 3D shapes that you can feel. So you can see the virtual knob or switch, and using this technology now, you can actually feel like you're turning a knob or flipping a switch. Ultra Haptics recently completed a $600,000 seed round of investment. Subramanian says that the money allowed the company to improve its computer power and performance.
Typically, what we've done is tried to create one focal point at a time, and that's been computationally quite expensive until now. What we've developed right now is a way in which we can speed up this process substantially. That means what's happened is that instead of doing one at a time, I can do hundreds at a time. And when I do hundreds at a time, and if I put 100 focal points around your fingertip, or on your palm, those 100 feel like a circle. Right? And if I track your palm and move them up and down, and if I change the diameter of these focal points, you start feeling like you're going through a sphere. And this is how we generate a shape.
A promotional video for the company shows a DJ in a nightclub using virtual sliders to mix his music. It also shows someone using virtual controls in their kitchen and a driver using virtual controls in a car. But the device is still in the prototype stage, and Subramanian says it has a wide range of applications, from controls, touchable holograms, immersive virtual reality, and even medicine, where doctors could actually feel a disease, such as a tumor.
You can see the object, and you can maybe interact with this object visually, but you don't feel anything. What we're offering is that missing dimension of feeling these holographic objects. That, I think, is the crucial distinction, as well as the advantage of what we're offering. We're not saying get rid of the holographic display. All we're saying is that attach our system to it, and then you can start feeling objects as well as seeing them. This gives you better finesse and control.
Subramanian says that as more and more of our lives becomes virtual, with computer-operated controls, switches, and interaction, people will still need to feel what they're doing. And that's where his product comes in.
There is a tendency towards doing things touchless. One of the advantages of having a touchless system is that the interaction comes to you. Instead of going and touching the light switch, you just wave your hand and the light turns on, right? This is going to be ubiquitous. And as it becomes ubiquitous, people are going to need this kind of tactile feedback.
Sriram Subramanian and his team are currently running an evaluation program to come up with applications for this technology. Ultra Haptics plans to license the tech to a number of markets, including consumer electronics, home appliances, and even the automotive industry. So what's your opinion? Would you use a virtual control even if the physical device you feel isn't there? What are some applications you can think of that this kind of technology could improve? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Alaska Airlines Flight 448 had an extra passenger from Seattle to Los Angeles the other day. They had to go back to Seattle just 14 minutes after they were in the air because the pilot reported hearing banging from underneath the aircraft. It happened that a ramp agent got caught in the belly of the plane, and as he said, after they arrived on the ground, he fell asleep. Well, I guess after taking off and getting into the air, he woke up and got their attention. They took him in an ambulance just as a precaution. It's time for sports on Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. World number one men's tennis player Novak Djokovic of Serbia scored an easy 6-1, 6-4 victory over Albert Ramos Vinales in Monte Carlo, and he was pleased with the win Tuesday on the clay courts.
Felt very good. I thought, considering the amount of months that I haven't played on the clay courts, and to play against somebody that is a clay court specialist and win in two sets, I thought it was a very good performance, and I can just take positives from today. Maybe at the beginning of the second, there were a few games where I did drop a little bit with intensity and concentration, but overall, was a high-quality performance, and I'm happy for that.
Djokovic has spent a lot of time as the number one player in the world, and he reflects his time at the top of the rankings.
I think sixth on the all-time list, the number one's week spent the number one is, of course, it's an incredible achievement. I'm very proud of it, and no question about it that I'm aware of it. So the kind of a mindset that brought me to where I am right now is a mindset of a player that is very, you know, committed, dedicated, disciplined, and very much in the present moment. So I don't want to take my thoughts too far ahead because then I'll lose the necessary focus that actually keeps me where I am.
Well, Djokovic is looking ahead at least to the third round of the tournament, where he will play either Bernard Tomic or Andreas Heider-Maurer. The NBA's regular season is just about complete. Some of the league's elite are jockeying not only for top playoff seeds to decide matchups, but also for the right to host those playoff games. Home court advantage is determined solely by record, not by seeding or if teams happen to win their divisions. In the Western Conference, Anthony Davis and the resilient Pelicans are close to edging out injury-plagued Oklahoma City for the conference's eighth and final playoff position. That would be New Orleans' first postseason appearance in over 4 years. That's a look at sports on VOA Global.
After many years as band leader of the late-night U.S. TV program, The Tonight Show, guitarist Kevin Eubanks left the show in 2010. Now he's gotten his jazz group back, pairing up with guitarist Stanley Jordan for a new album, Duets. Nature Boy is the third cut on the album, which includes original compositions and lots of old favorites as well as new hits. The recording label Mac Avenue. Eubanks and Jordan got together to talk about their collaboration.
we've been kind of on the same record labels and same festivals like throughout our careers. So it was about time that we hooked it up. And we were trying to go over. What are some of the other names you have for the record?
Black and Blacker.
Black and Blacker. That's like a Chris Rock movie or something. I don't know.
Kevin was really busy, and I was trying to get his attention, you know, because I was getting pressure from the label, like, you guys need a title. So I thought, okay, how can I get his attention? So I sent him an email, like an official-looking email that said, you know, if you don't respond within 48 hours, the title of the record will be Black and Blacker. And he got back to me within like an hour and said, no.
On Duets, Eubanks and Jordan's intimate, relaxed style is evident in the more spontaneous rather than overproduced mixing of some jazz standards, as well as contemporary pop tunes and original compositions. Morning Sun is one of two original songs on Duets. Other cuts on Duets include Thad Jones' ballad, A Child is Born, Miles Davis's Blue and Green, George Gershwin's Summertime, and a moving interpretation of Adele's hit, Someone Like You. Duets is the first recording together for Kevin Eubanks and Stanley Jordan. They've been friends since the early 1980s, always displaying some special chemistry. That's Music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
Mysterious artists who planted a bust of Edward Snowden on a New York City Revolutionary War monument now say they want to free their sculpture from police custody and display it again. They say it was intended as a thought-provoking gift to the city. The artists are applying for permission to show parkgoers the likeness of the former National Security Agency secret leaker. That, according to their lawyer, who is not secret, Ronald Kuby, who told police this in a letter. In the meantime, a Manhattan gallery now wants to show off the sculpture next month. The gallery says, "We feel the piece would offer a great deal of good and reflect on the city's history as a home for free thinkers if exhibited through a temporary Art in the Parks program." The artists, who have kept their identity secret, Police say they're holding the sculpture while investigating its unauthorized Dark of Night appearance back on April 6th in Fort Greene Park. It was removed in hours after its discovery. Deputy Chief Kim Royster would not comment on the status of the probe, but noted that police may return the confiscated property after their investigations conclude. It was over a meter high, 100 pounds, fiberglass-reinforced cement bust of Snowden, who is now living in exile in Russia after divulging secret U.S. government collections of phone records. And it turned up on a monument that honors American captives who died on British prison ships during the Revolutionary War. Well, we don't have a statue or a bust in our honor, but we do have several people we like to recognize, like our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. Join us right here again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.